54 through 56, 57 through 59, three chapters in each case, complement each other. They're kind of polar opposites. And in both cases, though, God is appealing to his people through Isaiah at that time to recognize that they need to serve him in their time, in their circumstances, whatever they are, but they also need to keep their eyes to that distant horizon that God is going to fulfill the ultimate prophecies that will result in the kingdom that you and I enjoy so very, very much. So, as we begin tonight, we are not going to go immediately into Isaiah 55. We finished the 54th chapter last week. We'll look at 55, tail end of the class tonight. But as I've done before with Isaiah, I want to do this again tonight. The first time I've presented this material in this format and in this manner. And so, what I should do is get in the car and go home and get the 40 sheets that I printed out so each of you could have one. And left, on my desk. Here's my key. There's a stack of papers that is about these three things. It's a spreadsheet that I printed one for everybody. It has these three columns. It's on my desk, I'm sure. I pulled them out and get them in the briefcase. So, what we're going to do, though, is, I'll get to the sheets in a little bit, or she will. Isaiah is going to give us a very long list of prophecies, and we're going to just do it an overview here tonight. These prophecies I will give you titles for, and then we are about to discover that while Isaiah is the second most quoted Old Testament book in the New Testament, only Psalms is quoted more often in the New Testament than Isaiah, and not by a whole lot. But with no competition, you know, remotely close, in Revelation, Isaiah is there. Isaiah, in these last 27 chapters, is very frequently about Revelation. And Revelation, conversely, is about Isaiah. And particularly, it starts tonight. Now, there's been a couple before that, which I'll show you in a minute. But tonight, it becomes nearly constant. There'll be a chapter or two through to the end of the book that is not going to be quoted or somehow referenced in the book of Revelation. But they'll be rare from this point on. So for the next 12 chapters, brethren, you can't hardly read without finding Revelation. If you know to look for it, if you're familiar enough with Revelation to recognize, Revelation either directly quotes or clearly is referring to this material. So, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go just down to this center column first. I had intended to do it this way anyway, so we're really not losing anything. I'll get the charts to you. John will be back in 10 minutes, in the place I wanted to do it anyway. But just as an overview right now, we are going to see prophecies tonight that set up a picture of a husband and a wife. Marital relationship. It's come up before between God and man, how he views his people. But particularly tonight, there's this husband-wife that is set forth as something that God wants us to recognize. Then, we're going to read about a city made of jewels. And we're going to read promises about being free from oppression and fear. Your enemies will all be defeated. There will be springs and rivers of free water. There will be a better and everlasting name. The foreigners, which is yet another term for Gentiles, like nations, several terms, but those that are not Jews will be worshiping God. There will be no darkness or gloom anymore because the light of the Lord will be present. Nations, that is the Gentiles again, will come to this light. Foreign kings will come into this light and into this kingdom and be serving in this kingdom. The gates will never close. There's going to be a city of God. And these are the passages in Isaiah. These are the passages in Revelation. And you'll note on more than one occasion, these will be themes that come up as many as three times in Isaiah, and as many, actually, as five in a given section of the book of Revelation. So I didn't even put them all up here by any means, and I probably missed some in the years that I've been working on this list and trying to identify these things. I change it every time I go to study either Revelation or Isaiah. You know, reconsider all of this. And that's not all. We're going to find out that mourning, grieving, is finished. There is a wrathful, bloody king. His robes are dipped in blood. He will be trampling a winepress. But there are certain ones who will eat and drink and rejoice in the midst of all of this, because there's a new heavens and a new earth and a new Jerusalem. Where do all these terms, these concepts, these illustrations, these promises, these great prophecies come from? They come from Isaiah. And brethren, they're fulfilled in Revelation. And so what I hope to present tonight is to help you to appreciate that when God said to Isaiah these things, you have in Isaiah very clearly, everybody knows, you have physical prophecies that will take place down on planet Earth in particular times that will impact nations throughout the centuries that are to come. And then there's a suffering servant, a magnificent Savior. There's a great king. The child will be born, and he will rule with a rod of iron. There is an ultimate fulfillment of a spiritual kingdom that is far superior to all of this other stuff that's going to go on through the ages as the saints of the Old Testament times are waiting for these prophecies to be fulfilled. And so, what we'll see as we go down through this is that Isaiah is chosen by God to be the figure prophet of the book of Revelation. If you get what Isaiah is talking about, Revelation just becomes so much clearer. Here's all the fulfillment, the same terminology over and over and over again. If you get into Revelation and you know that these things are being quoted from Isaiah, then it's also helping us to understand Isaiah. Because these last chapters, as I mentioned last week, are just jam-packed with so much information. And enough, you know, quite a few times, you're looking at Isaiah and lacking how it's used in these other books of the Bible, and not just Revelation, but I'm focusing on Revelation now, you know, not realizing the relationship between the two. Revelation is a little darker, and Isaiah is a little darker to you. So tonight, I really hope to give you a take home. You'll be able to have all this information you saw flash before you. You can go back and you can look at this, you know, yourself. And I highly recommend you do. It's done me a lot of good several times. I've been through it all. But what it tells us is that Isaiah is talking about a coming kingdom that will come down out of heaven to the earth. Where that new kingdom, having come down out of heaven to be on the earth, is described as a new heavens, a new earth, and a new city, which is the bride of Christ, a figure that Paul, of course, also uses. And so hopefully when you get done tonight, I want to accomplish, you know, that same shiver in your spine that says, wow, I just had no idea that these two books were such mirrors of each other. Just didn't know that Isaiah is so constant in the book of Revelation's latter chapters. So what I'm going to do is put the chart up that Donna will be back with in just a few minutes. I've timed it. It takes 90 seconds to drive from here to my house. That's the truth. It's 90 seconds. So you've got to go in the house and get stuff and come back. You know, so it'll be a little bit longer than that. But we're talking about 3 minutes and the turnaround. So I'll be right back. But what I've now done is taken the preceding two charts and just simply put them on a single page. And then, you know, it's all exactly the same information. So I'm going to go ahead and start into this. And then you'll have the take home as well. Here's what I'd like to try for the first time. Let's see how this works out. Everybody, stay in Isaiah. Keep your fingers limber. I'll give you the verse references. You read Isaiah. I'll read Revelation. Did I tell you? Everybody, look, there she is. Less than 5 minute turnaround. Pretty cool. And under the speed limit, too. I can see that. Okay, so she'll hand those out, and maybe somebody else can give you a hand with that. But as that's coming out, you stay in Isaiah. I will read from Revelation. In this manner, we'll be able to go more rapidly, because you're staying in one book, and I'm staying in the other book. I'll read the passage as it's fulfilled in the book of Revelation. You'll be reading the passage as it is prophesied in the book of Isaiah. So, everybody turn all the way back now to your Isaiah 54. You're going to be in Isaiah 54 and verse 5. Now, as these are being passed out, please note that on that very first one about this husband and bride, you will also have listed in the Isaiah column chapter 61, verse 10, and chapter 62, verses 4 and 5 and 12. So it'll be up to you to just keep up with me. I'll read, in this case, Revelation 19, verses 7 through 9, and then chapter 21, verses 2, 9, and 10. So while I'm doing my thing, you do your thing, and we'll have to work at it, you know, together that way. But I'm going to start reading now the first line in chapter 19, verses 7 through 9. Here's what we have in Revelation. Let us rejoice and be glad and give the glory to him, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his bride has made herself ready. And it was given to her to clothe herself in fine linen, bright and clean, for the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints. And he said to me, write, blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said to me, these are true words of God. And that was 19, verses 7 through 9. Now I'm reading chapter 21, verses 2, 9, and 10. I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. And one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues came and spoke with me, saying, come here, I shall show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. Now, we're going to talk about this city made of jewels. You'll be in Isaiah 54, verses 11 and 12. I'm going to be in 21, 11 through 21. So, he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain, showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, having the glory of God. Her brilliance was like a very costly stone, as a stone of crystal clear jasper, had a great high wall with 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, names were written on them, which are the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel. 3 gates on the east, 3 on the north, 3 gates on the south, and 3 on the west, and the wall had 12 foundation stones, and on them were the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. The one who spoke with me had a gold measuring rod to measure the city and its gates and its wall, and the city is laid out as a square. Its length is as great as the width. He measured the city with the rod 1,500 miles. Its length and width and height are equal, and he measured its wall 72 yards, according to human measurements, which are also angelic measurements. The material of the wall was jasper, and the city was pure gold, like clear glass. The foundation stones of the city were adorned with every kind of precious stone. The first foundation stone was jasper, the second sapphire, the third chalcedony, the fourth emerald, the fifth sardonyx, then sardius, chrysolite, beryl, topaz, chrysoprase, jacinth, and the 12th amethyst. And the 12 gates were 12 pearls. Each one of the gates was a single pearl, and the street of the city was pure gold, like transparent glass. Now, In this case, we have an illustration.
No, you're only reading two verses.
I'm reading 12. And as I'm reading these extra verses here,
that's 11, I guess it was.
As I'm reading these verses, you know, in much more detail, you just had, you know, a short burst. In this case, we see similarities, but they're not really dramatic. It's not like a quotation at all. So as we go through, you'll be picking that up. Sometimes these are very strong, and they're absolutely undeniable, and even lengthier direct quotations. Sometimes they're only, as this one was, an allusion. That is, alluding to this idea back in Revelation. So again, though, if you'll now just go a couple of verses ahead in chapter 54 to verse 14, we'll talk about this freedom from oppression or fear as I read from chapter 21 and verse 4. He shall wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall no longer be death. There shall no longer be mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away. Continuing, you will, in chapter 54, now to verses 15, 16, and 17, I'm going to read about the defeat of all enemies in chapter 19, verses 19 through 21. I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies assembled to make war against him who sat upon the horse and against his army. The beast was seized, and with him the false prophet who performed the signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These two were thrown alive into the lake of fire which burns with brimstone. And the rest were killed with the sword which came from the mouth of him who sat upon the horse, and all the birds were filled with their flesh. So we have the similar ideas of enemies being defeated, which continues now in chapter 20 and verses 7 through 10. When the 1,000 years are completed, Satan will be released from his prison. He'll come out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together for the war. The number of them is like the sand of the seashore. They came up on the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. And fire came down from heaven and devoured them. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are also, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. So, great war, but all the enemies are defeated and cast away. Now, this next one's particularly enjoyable. You will at your leisure move from chapter 49, verse 10, to chapter 55 and verse 1, and then to chapter 58 and verse 11, while we speak of springs and rivers of free water, which first appeared in Revelation at chapter 7 in verses 16 and 17. Chapter 7, verse 16, they shall hunger no more, neither thirst no anymore, neither shall the sun beat down on them, nor any heat, for the Lamb in the center of the throne shall be their shepherd, and shall guide them to springs of the water of life, and God shall wipe every tear from their eyes. Then again, I'm reading now from chapter 21 and verse 6. He said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give to the one who thirsts from the spring of the water of life without cost. And finally, in chapter 22 and verse 1, he showed me a river of the water of life, clear as crystal, coming from the throne of God and of the Lamb. Now again, you will be turning to chapter 56, verse 5, and then 62, verse 2, and then 65, verse 15, because this new, this better, this everlasting name is found at least four times. I found several others, but I'm going to read four of them in the book of Revelation with regard to this everlasting name. In chapter 2, and in verse 17, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, to him I will give of the hidden manna, and I will give him a white stone and a new name written on the stone, which no one knows but he who receives it. And then again to these seven churches a second time, now in chapter 3 and verse 12 to Philadelphia, he says, "He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. He will not go out from it anymore. I will write upon him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and my new name." And then again, I'll be reading from chapter 14 and verse 1. In 14 and verse 1, "I looked, and behold, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion, with him 144,000, having his name and the name of his Father written on their foreheads." And lastly, at chapter 22 and in verse 4, the last chapter of the book, "They shall see his face, and his name shall be on their foreheads." So in this case, you had three references to it back in the Old Testament. You've got four or more in the book of Revelation. Now let's talk about these foreigners. You'll be at 56, chapter 56, verses 6, 7, and 8. I'll be in chapter 15 to begin at verses 3 and 4. Chapter 15 at verse 3. "They sang the song of Moses, the bondservant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, Great and marvelous are your works, O Lord God the Almighty. Righteous and true are your ways, you King of the nations. Who will not fear, O Lord, and glorify your name? For you alone are holy. For all the nations will come and worship before you. For your righteous acts have been revealed." And now I'll turn to chapter 21, verses 24 through 27. "The nations shall walk by its light, and the kings of the earth shall bring their glory into it. And in the daytime, for there shall be no night there, the gate shall never be closed. They shall bring the glory and the honor of the nations into it, and nothing unclean, and no one who practices abomination and lying shall ever come into it, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life." You'll now, with regard to the darkness and the gloom, be in chapter 58 and verse 10. I'll be reading from chapter 21 again. Now, same passages, 23 and 20, I'm not going to read it. You just look at 58:10, because both these things are discussed in the same passage that I just looked at. So I'm going to move on here to the light of the Lord, which is the antithesis, you know, the way this one was put, there's no darkness, but now we have the light to tell us why. You'll be in chapter 60, verses 1 and 2, and also in chapter 60 at verses 19 and 20. I've just read it for a third time in 21, verses 23 and 24, but I'm also going to read now from chapter 22 and verse 5. "There shall no longer be any night. They shall not have need of the light of a lamp, nor the light of the sun, because the Lord God shall illumine them, and they shall reign forever and ever." Now, the nations will come to this light so that there is the light of the Lord in banishing darkness and gloom. You'll be looking at chapter 60 and verse 3, the next verse where you're already at, as I read from chapter 21 and verse 26, "They shall bring the glory and the honor of the nations into it." So the nations are coming to that light that now four times in a row is discussed in chapter 21, verses 23 through 27. Now then, these foreign kings crop up again. You're still in chapter 60. You're now looking at verse 10. As I read in chapter 21, verses 24 and 26 again, "The nations shall walk by its light. The kings of the earth shall bring their glory into it. Then they shall bring the glory and the honor of the nations into it." Now you'll go to the next verse, chapter 60, verse 11. I'm reading next verse, chapter 21, verse 25. "And in the daytime, for there shall be no night there, its gates shall never be closed." The gates are never to be closed. This on the city of God. So you're reading in chapter 60, verse 14, it's the gates in the city of God that are never closed. In chapter 21 of Revelation, it's verses 2, 9, and 10, which we've already read. But here they are again, 21:2, I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues came and spoke to me, saying, come here, I shall show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And he carried me away in the Spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. Let me just pause for a second to point out, last week the first verses in chapter 54 were quoted at length as well as discussed in what Bible book of the New Testament? Can you remember? Where did we spend so much time last week in the New Testament? Galatians. Chapter 4. Galatians 4 is quoting directly and says so from Isaiah chapter 54. So, well, this new city is about, brethren, is lifted from Isaiah and is discussed in Galatians. Galatians is most likely the first New Testament book that's ever written. And it's a whole lot about the fulfillment of the Old Testament in the coming of a New Testament that is just a warning for the Gentiles in the time that the Galatian letter is written, which will be right during the 15th chapter of Acts that we'll be getting to very shortly. So brethren, we've got ties to other parts of the New Testament as well. Hebrews also is going to mention this new heavens and earth in Jerusalem. And beyond all conceivable doubt, in those other books which we studied last week, 1 Peter mentions it every time. It's the church. It's the church. It's the kingdom on earth beyond all doubt is the way it's used in Hebrews and in 1 Peter and in Galatians. It's not dying to go to heaven. It's not the end of the world to go to heaven. It's not discussing heaven at all. It's not skipping over the entire church and the coming of the kingdom to go talk about heaven. Isaiah lives before the kingdom. He is predicting the kingdom. The kingdom will be fulfilled in the New Testament. And Revelation is talking about the kingdom. It's talking about the church. So this city of God that you've just seen in chapter 60 and verse 14 is in chapter 21 of Revelation at verses 2, 9, and 10. And within it, all mourning, all grieving is finished. Now I might go through this and change this somewhat. You know, we've already had, you know, a similar thought earlier. But in this case, you're looking at the last of four lines in chapter 60, verse 20. Then you'll go on to chapter 61, verses 2 and 3, and you'll end up in chapter 65 and verse 19. As I read from Revelation chapter 7 and verse 17, which sounds like this, the Lamb in the center of the throne shall be their shepherd, and shall guide them to springs of the water of life, and God shall wipe every tear from their eyes. This is also an idea you'll find in 21:4. Which says, he shall wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall no longer be death, no longer be mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away. And now, we're about to come to the single most dramatic passage of all, I suppose. This wrathful, bloody king that you're going to read in the six verses at the beginning of chapter 63. You read 63, 1 through 6. I'm reading chapter 19, verses 11 through 16. I saw heaven opened, and behold a white horse, and he who sat upon it is called Faithful and True. And in righteousness he judges and wages war. And his eyes are a flame of fire, and upon his head are many diadems, and he has a name written upon him, which no one knows except himself. And he is clothed with a robe dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which are in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, were following him on white horses, and from his mouth comes a sharp sword, so that with it he may smite the nations. And he will rule them with a rod of iron, and he treads the winepress the fierce wrath of God the Almighty, you know, on his robe, you know, on his thigh, he has a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. There is your wrathful, bloody king. And as you're reading in Isaiah, and I'm reading in Revelation, you see how many times you have these similar ideas. This has got to be the same individual prophesied by Isaiah and now fulfilled in Revelation. Well, no surprise, you've just read it, but as you now look again at chapter 63 and verse 3, I'll read from chapter 14, verses 17 through 20. Another angel came out of the temple, which is in heaven, and he also had a sharp sickle. And another angel, the one who has power over fire, came out from the altar, and he called with a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle, saying, "Put in your sharp sickle and gather the clusters from the vine of the earth, because her grapes are ripe." And the angel swung his sickle to the earth and gathered the clusters of the vine from the earth and threw them into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden outside the city. And blood came out from the winepress up to the horses' bridles for a distance of 200 miles. Now then, you'll be reading chapter 65 and verse 13 about this eating and drinking and rejoicing. I've just mentioned it a moment ago in chapter 7, verse 16. Thusly, they shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more, neither the sun beat down upon them, nor any heat. But we'll also find this idea of rejoicing in chapter 21 and in verse 6. He said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give to the one who thirsts from the spring of the water of life without cost." Remember the no cost, because it's coming up shortly. The next to the last category, as we wrap this chart up, is the new heavens and the new earth. You'll read 65:17 and 66:22. I'm reading 21:1. "I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth passed away, and there's no longer any sea." New heavens and earth. You're reading now 65:18, the next verse in chapter 65. I'm reading from chapter 3, verse 12 first, which we read earlier. "He who overcomes, I'll make him a pillar in the temple of my God. He'll not go out from it anymore, and I will write upon him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and my new name." And then lastly, I'm reading 21:1. "I saw a new heavens and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there's no longer any sea." And I conclude with verse 10 in chapter 21. "He carried me away in the Spirit to a great and high mountain, showed me the holy city Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God." Okay? Now there's the chart. I've never presented this material like this before. If you don't like it, keep it to yourself. If you love it, come tell it. Okay, everyone, I realize that's, you know, that's just a blitzkrieg of information. But do you see what I mean? If you're looking at Isaiah, you're looking at Revelation. If you're looking at Revelation, you're looking at Isaiah. And when you start studying the contexts around the passages in both books, it becomes abundantly plain. We are not talking about heaven. We are talking about Jesus ruling the nations with a rod of iron. And there will be all kinds of unrighteous people, but they won't be coming into this kingdom. Rather, there are no unrighteous people in heaven. So we don't have to talk about them not being able to get into the kingdom. But on the earth, there are unrighteous people. They're never in the kingdom. We come out of that unrighteousness to get into that kingdom. That new kingdom is described in terms of a new heaven, a new earth, and a new city. The new city is Jerusalem, our mother from above, in Galatians chapter 4. Paul said so. And he was still on the earth talking about people on the earth. Now that you've got the chart, you got a lot of work ahead of you. Because I know how deeply ingrained it is in our minds and everybody else's. These terms are all talking about heaven.
No, they're not. They're not. We've got to keep things in context. Yes, I can see why you think that. And I did it. From 1973 to 1987. Matter of fact, for 14 years I believe that. And as the years went by, I started studying context, seeing things, you know, around the edges, and realizing it won't work if you try to make these symbols refer to heaven. It will work if you can see the fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy. And in the judgment scenes, the judgment upon whom? The Jews who rejected their Messiah. And Jesus told them so in the whole of Matthew chapter 24, Mark 13, Luke 17, and Luke 21, and many other places. As also Paul will talk about it. That bloody judgment scene and the wrath of God fell upon those Jews in what 3.5 year period? 66 to 70 A.D. When was the temple burned to the ground? September of 70 A.D. When was that old covenant not only banished and abolished in reality and in heaven because of what Jesus had done on the cross and what he had conquered in the grave, but in reality was now demolished, annihilated, and wiped out so that no Jew could claim that that religion was the religion of God. Brethren, in 70 A.D., the temple was burned to the ground. God gave them 40 years to come to the Christ. They wouldn't do it. And the wrath of God, bloody as it was, took 3.5 years to fall upon those people. And Revelation's many chapters have an enormous amount of information about those 3.5 years. So, that is our last chart for the night. With a little over 10 minutes, we're going to go now over to Isaiah 55. With any luck, we'll finish the entirety of that chapter, verse by verse. Because, while as you have seen, and you have the chart to demonstrate, connections to Revelation have already been made in Isaiah since 49:10. But, here's 55:1. Hello, everyone who has thirst, come to the waters. You who have no money, come, buy, eat. Come, buy wine and milk without money, without cost. Why do you spend money for what is not bread, and your wages for what does not satisfy? Listen carefully to me and eat what is good and delight yourself in abundance. Incline your ear and come to me. Listen that you may live, and I will make an everlasting covenant with you according to the faithful mercies shown to David. Behold, I made him a witness to the peoples, singular or plural, the leader and a commander for the peoples, singular or plural. Behold, you will call a nation you do not know, and a nation which knows you not will run to you because of the Lord your God, even the Holy One of Israel, for he has glorified you. Did that ever happen in Old Testament times? Of course not. Did it happen when the Gentiles came into the kingdom of God, beginning officially in chapter 10 of the book of Acts? Oh, and by the way, please grab your pencil, because verse 3 is quoted in Acts chapter 13 and verse 34. In Acts chapter 13 and in verse 34, which we'll be looking at this upcoming Sunday morning, it says this: as for the fact that he raised him up from the dead, no more to return to decay, he has spoken in this way, I will give you the holy and sure blessings of David. Therefore, now note the connection between these two verses, therefore he also says in another psalm, you will not allow your Holy One to undergo decay. You know as well as I do, that is Psalm 16. It is quoted in Acts 2. The argument is made that David could not be talking about himself because we've got his tomb right here. When that sermon is preached in Acts chapter 2, The holy and sure blessings of David are being argued. Christ is risen from the dead. His body would not see decay. His body was only 3 days in the grave. He was not abandoned to Hades, but that's who David was talking about. The holy and sure blessings that were given to David were not about David. They were about Jesus. So Isaiah 55 speaks of the holy and sure blessing. Psalm 16 gets coupled with it to say it's about a resurrection from the dead, that holy and sure blessing. And Peter preaches it in Acts chapter 2. And it's not about going to heaven. It's about the very first people who will ever be baptized into Christ. We're talking about an everlasting covenant, the faithful mercies of David. Are we talking about going to heaven, or are we talking about the arrival of the kingdom 7 centuries after Isaiah? We're talking about the fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy. And the nations, mentioned again and again and again in that section, are coming into it as it's mentioned again and again and again in Revelation. Oh, by the way, I got to go back now. I meant to ask. I'm sorry, I forgot. I read an awful lot of passages in Revelation. Look at your chart, man. I'm putting it back up right here. It's going to pop up in just a minute. But if you look at the chart, what do you notice about the Revelation side? Is there anything that kind of jumps out at you? Most of them are in the last chapters, 21 and 22. This is where I think the big mistake in our understanding of Revelation traditionally has taken place. We're not getting Revelation 21 and 22. And the reason for that, typically, is that we're divorcing it from Isaiah. Which is not right. It's just Isaiah everywhere. Well, curious thing, I always have to do this, and I tell you, it breaks my heart, because once again, for the umpteenth time, I believe Homer Healy is the greatest scholar to live in the 20th century, bar none. Brought more people to Christ, taught more preachers, sent them out all over the world. That man did more good in the 20th century than any other man there is. His commentary on Isaiah is just the only one worth having. And it's just fabulously good. And you know what he thinks all those chapters, 60 and especially 65 and 66, are talking about? The church. It's the church. The church is the church. He's so right. But Homer, I believe if he'd lived 5 more years, he would have figured this out. Homer writes a commentary on Revelation, and he says it's heaven, it's heaven, it's heaven. That caught my attention long years ago. Homer. It's the same terminology. In Isaiah, you say it's the church. In Revelation, you say it's heaven. Why are you doing that? Why are you doing that? Why wouldn't it be the prophecy and the fulfillment of the coming of the kingdom? Well, I'm just real sure that it is. So, you know, I tell you, I want to dig a hole every time I crawl in it, you know, pull dirt over my head, wait for the bombs to fall. Any guy that says Homer Healy had something to learn, you know, is just out of his mind. But I think Homer Healy, you know, if you just had a few more years, you know, we would have got there with it. So there's a disconnect. And so you bet most of that is all in the last chapters. Now we start in verse 6 in Isaiah 55. Here's 5. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he's near. What does that imply? Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord, and he will have compassion on him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares Yahweh. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. For as the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return there without watering the earth and making it bare and sprout and furnishing seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be, which goes forth from my mouth. It shall not return to me empty, without accomplishing what I desire, without succeeding in that for which I sent it. For you will go out with joy and be led forth with peace.
The mountains and the hills will break forth into shouts of joy before you. All the trees of the field will clap their hands. Instead of the thorn bush, the cypress will come up. Instead of the nettle, the myrtle will come up. And it'll be a memorial to the Lord for an everlasting sign which will not be cut off. Now, brethren, this is Isaiah singing the praises of a coming kingdom, of a joy that is to come. And as now you know, thanks to the chart, all the meaning we're going to do at the end of this book now, you will see endless numbers of symbols that represent the difference between a physical nation and a spiritual kingdom, that represent how all things of the flesh can never touch you in a spiritual kingdom, that no enemy can prosper, no weapon can succeed. This grand contrast between all the physicality of the Old Testament, that Isaiah had seen most of it destroyed in his day. The Assyrians took 10 northern tribes. They surrounded Jerusalem, wiped out the countryside before 185,000 of them died. Isaiah was living in a very turbulent time, a very physical time, a time of judgment. And he was writing endlessly. The antithesis of all of that in a spiritual kingdom where none of these things are to be feared, where covenants are eternal, okay, where we are the saints of God, but still living here on the earth. It just, you know, as the years went by and I became more settled in my convictions, it just became so glaring to me how we look at all these Old Testament prophecies, and then in most of them, we entirely skip the whole church age to go to heaven. Well, if there's all these prophecies of a thing that's coming, you'd think God might have been interested in telling us about it having come. And I'm telling you, he sure enough did. But we kept calling it heaven and couldn't see where God was shaking hands between the Old Testament and the New and saying, "See, I told you." And it was worth waiting for, wasn't it? You bet it was. Thanks so much for your attention.